The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
You know, so much of what actually gets out to the public depends on, getting your message out through these platforms that control, you know, different speech rules. And, you know, this isn't so much a problem for just posting events and those kinds of things, as much as it's become, I think, a concern for many people around the world that when it comes to issues like hate speech or disinformation or harassment, the platforms are very disconnected from kind of the cultural norms, the legal norms, you know, the political norms that exist in a particular country. And that just created a lot of alienation for people. And I don't think it's resolved, because governments have done very little, you know, even in those places where, you know, like in Europe, where they've been talking about regulation for a long time, they've done very little to actually regulate. And so the platforms still have this massive power.
I'm Jacob Schultz, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, May 16th, 2020. The global pandemic has raised searching questions about the relationship between a public health emergency and free speech. Jack Goldsmith sat down with David Kaye, the outgoing UN Special Rapporteur on the promotion and protection of the right to freedom of opinion and expression, to talk about Kaye's new UN report on disease pandemics and the freedom of information and expression. The pair discussed the impact the pandemic has had on hostility to speech in different parts of the world, the importance of information during a pandemic, and much more. It's the Lawfare Podcast, May 16th. David Kaye on free speech during a pandemic.
David, thanks for joining me today. You recently issued your last report as the UN Special Rapporteur on the promotion and protection of the right of freedom of opinion and expression. And the topic couldn't have been more timely. It was on disease pandemics and freedom of opinion and expression. Tell us about the report, please.
Yeah, thanks. So, yeah, this is my last report. My mandate ends at the end of July. And this report, you know, it wasn't the report that I expected to close out my mandate with, but it seemed to me that, you know, with the pandemic happening right now and with so much swirling about around, you know, the freedom of the press, access to information, and the role of information when it comes to dealing with a pandemic, it seemed just essential to write about this at this particular moment. And so, you know, what I try to do is a couple of things. One, I start with actually with not a human rights focus, but a public health focus. And, you know, in doing my research, I came across this really interesting document that the WHO had prepared a couple of years ago called Managing Epidemics. And in it, it talks about the importance of information in dealing with pandemics and the importance of what they call risk communication. And I found that really interesting because, you know, what they're basically suggesting is that governments need to be honest and clear with the public about the nature of the threat, and also to deal with disinformation, you know, something that I know you've been thinking about for a long time. deal with disinformation, not through penalty, but deal with disinformation through the tools of correction and listening. And I thought that was a really interesting approach. So I kind of use that as a wedge in order to get into the issues that the report covers, which involve access to information, internet access, the role of the media at a time of pandemic. And I put all of that in the framework of freedom of expression and international human rights law.
Great. So it's a great report. I'm amazed that you were able to do it so quickly. You must have started it. I mean, it came out in April 23rd, I think, and you must have started it just a couple of months earlier. I mean, you couldn't have spent a lot of time thinking about this. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I had been thinking about the possibility of pandemic for a little bit longer, mainly because of some international travel that I was facing in February. So I was alert to it before and had been thinking about it before, but it's true. I mean, a lot of the big threats that we've seen over the last 6 weeks that we can talk about, you know, those weren't really evident to me until I'd say the very beginning of March, which was when I started writing this.
So what's your basic assessment? Most of the report is addressed, correct me if I get anything wrong, most of the report is addressed to governments. You have some discussion near the end about social media and private firms, and we'll get to that. So what is your basic overall assessment about how things are going? I mean, this is an emergency. It's an extreme emergency. It's not a pretextual emergency like many emergencies where speech is threatened. It's a real emergency. So we can expect the government to take a little bit heavier hand. I think Article 19 of the ICCPR contemplates some more aggressive action. You might not put it that way. But why don't you tell us what the framework is and what your overall assessment is?
Yeah. So, I mean, starting with the framework, this is a report for the Human Rights Council. I use the tools of international human rights law to do the assessment. It's not the only way of looking at these issues, but it's the way that the Human Rights Council has essentially mandated that I advise it and advise governments on these issues. And so, you know, just the basic framework is Article 19 provides everyone's and provides it guarantees it's, you know, the right of everyone to freedom of opinion without interference. That's considered a non-derogable right. But for our purposes,
can you explain what a non-derogable right is for the audience?
Oh yeah. Yeah. It means that no matter, you know, what kind of public emergency, the state cannot interfere with your freedom of opinion. You know, it's hard to think through what that actually means as a matter of practice, because what does it mean to interfere with your opinion? It might mean, you know, getting inside someone's head. I mean, there are very few cases around it. And I don't deal with freedom of opinion that much in the context of this report. Instead, I focus on Article 19's guarantee that everyone has the right to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas of all kinds, regardless of frontiers and through any media. And it's from my perspective, it's a really robust statement of freedom of expression. And when I talk to students, I try to, you know, give them the sense that the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech or of the press. And it's really focused on government. And, you know, of course, we have law over centuries dealing with and expanding on what that means. But the, you know, freedom of expression in the ICCPR starts with rights. And I think it's a nice way to start. But it does, as you suggest, also provide space for government restriction. And the government restriction part says that governments can restrict expression so long as it is provided by law, and it's necessary and proportionate to protect a legitimate government objective.
And it lists public health as a government objective.
Exactly. And I think that part is important. And it goes to the thrust of your question, which is at a time of an actual threat to public health, government can take steps. It's as long as those steps are necessary, and as long as, you know, we say provided by law, that means that at least it's understood in the human rights framework to mean that we're not talking about law that is so vague that it provides government with excessive discretion to decide what's legitimate and what's not. It should be very clear. But you know, government does have the ability, and in the context of public health or national security and public order or the rights of others like privacy, you might say they have a responsibility to protect those objectives. And so I'm completely, and the report is you know, willing to see that there could be some restrictions on expression, but they do have to meet those tests of necessity.
And do you have a sense, let's just talk generally, maybe this is too broad, yeah. But what is your sense about how Article 19 and the norms associated with it are being abided by?
During the pandemic in particular?
Yeah, during the pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of variation, but I'm definitely concerned. And it's, I sort of have two different kinds of concerns. So one concern is, you know, is government taking steps that are actually necessary to deal with the pandemic? And so, you know, as you look around the world, I think we see different kinds of restrictions, for example, on journalists and their ability to cover the pandemic. And so some governments, for example, are making it harder for journalists to get access to government information or to get access to government officials when they're doing their stories or even to attend press briefings, many of which are now virtual. Those are restrictions that I think often fail to meet the necessity principle. But, you know, I understand that oftentimes they're trying to do the right thing in the context of meeting the concerns of the pandemic. They're for a public health purpose. But, you know, when you test them, they just might not meet that standard. I think those are the kinds of cases that we can work through with governments and encourage them to be more open and so forth. The bigger problems right now, I think, are the ones where governments are using the pandemic as a kind of cover to do things that they've wanted to do for a long time. I mean, a good example is Hungary right now, where the government has taken some extraordinary measures to clamp down on the press, for instance, and it's something that Viktor Orban has really wanted to do for a long time, and he's using the pandemic as a bit of an excuse in order to do some of those things. Those kinds of things, and you know, the jailings, the detentions of journalists around the world, which appear to be, you know, not slowing down. Those are the kinds of things that really concern me. I mean, and you know, there are states that are doing the right thing, that are being open with information, that are providing access to information, but there's certainly a lot of concern around the world about some of these other steps.
So, setting the Hungary example aside, how in general are democracies doing? How would you say? I mean, are there any? You've mentioned Hungary, but are there other democracies that you have special concerns about, or you've seen things that are concerning from the government?
Yeah, I mean, I have concern about our own in the United States. I think one of the problems, you know, and this will get us into a discussion about disinformation as well. I think one of the problems in a pandemic, and this is something I think we should all recognize, and that the public should also be somewhat flexible about. Information is changing. We don't have a lot of good information, or maybe stable information, or rigorous, you know, long-term studies of the coronavirus. And so, you know, what governments say about the coronavirus and the pandemic and the steps that we need to protect ourselves, you know, those are, I think, subject to change. There's evolving information around this. But I think we've seen in a number of places that governments are, and this is true in democratic countries as well as authoritarian ones, we've seen maybe not as robust of an effort to keep people informed and to treat people as adults when it comes to the uncertainty of the information that we're facing. And I think that's, you know, that's a freedom of expression issue. It's an access to information issue. And I think we need to be, you know, pushing governments as much as possible to meet their responsibility, not just sort of in a negative rights context, that is, you know, not just in their responsibility not to interfere with expression, but also, you know, their positive obligation to ensure that there's a strong environment for access to information so that people are, you know, are educated about the nature of the threat. I mean, there's one democracy I would highlight that deserves kind of a special criticism, and that's India. And mainly, although there are issues across India, I'm thinking about Kashmir because, you know, India, which, you know, really likes to refer to itself as the world's largest democracy, has more or less shut down the internet in Kashmir since last August, and it's gotten even worse in the last couple of days. That's an example of a real misuse of the situation of the pandemic in order to do things it's wanted to do for a long time.
So they're cracking down more under the guise of regulating the pandemic?
Under the guise of regulating the pandemic and under the guise of also, you know, sort of the long-term objective they've had around counterterrorism and public order in Kashmir. It's, in some respects, it's more along the lines of, look, people are distracted. You know, we can continue to do this thing that we're doing. And my argument is, you know, particularly in the context of the pandemic, they need to be opening up because there's been some really good reporting on how hard it has been for healthcare workers, for doctors and staff and hospitals to get information about the pandemic from outside the country, because until recently, you know, they only had 2G and people in Kashmir only had 2G speeds for the internet. Today, apparently it's even worse than that, like quite a bit of shutting down just over the last couple of days.
So can we come back to the case of the United States, and we'll focus on the government? And I do want to shift to the tech platforms in a second.
Yeah.
So what, I mean, you were basically describing not negative rights being violated, but kind of, it sounded like to me, a lack of full government transparency. Yeah. But I'm not really sure what you're talking about other than the president's kind of unfortunate performances. I mean, is there something beyond that that you think the government is doing wrong in terms of, from a human rights law perspective?
Yeah, no, I mean, There's definitely variation, but I am definitely most concerned with the performance of the president. But I mean, I think it's more the language of performance is interesting because I do think that he sees, you know, part of what he's doing as a performance. But I think that the specific kinds of language that he's used, the specific kind of, you know, I think has been deception around what's known about the threat, and in particular the kind of attacks on independent media have been, you know, really problematic. Now the media has gotten used to it, and I think in the United States the media is pretty resilient, but the overall effort to, you know, that I think the president has been engaged in for, you know, for the entirety of his presidency of, you know, kind of presenting the media as a negative force so that you can't trust its information is a very serious ongoing threat to, you know, to the independent media space in the US. But I agree. I mean, I think there are still processes that are ongoing. For example, you know, FOIA requests can still be made. It's a little bit harder to, you know, to get those answered. But I understand that because, you know, most government employees who would be working on FOIA right now are stuck at home in lockdown. That's the kind of, you know, restriction that we, I think, completely tolerate in a time of pandemic. The process still has to exist for people to get access to information. I think government is by and large trying to do that, but not at the, you know, the most senior levels.
Yeah. So you've alluded a couple of times to, you talked at the beginning about that book you read about risk communication. Was that the phrase
yeah.
you used? And
yes,
you talked
right.
about how, and I couldn't agree more, that you said that information related to the virus is not stable. Information is constantly changing. I mean, as I've tried to stay up to speed as a layperson, and I have to say every morning I wake up and read the news and I have a different view about it. And the experts seem to be changing or altering their views, and the models seem to be updating. This is happening. So this is an area where, as you said, information is vitally important.
Yeah.
It's also taking place in a context where a lot of people are at risk. And it's a situation where the information isn't stable. So it's a tough situation. I think it's like the toughest imaginable situation to think about optimal speech regulation, because before we even get to government versus private firms, I mean, one worries about information that would be truly harmful, but one also worries about someone making a judgment about what information is harmful and keeping information out of the public sphere that could end up bettering our understanding of the problem. It just seems to be a nightmare speech problem.
I do think it's a nightmare of a speech problem, but I think there's been, you know, we've got this great federal system, and so we can see different public authorities dealing with this in different ways. And I think, you know, it's becoming, you know, common just to look at how the governors in you know, California, Washington, Ohio, New York have been addressing, you know, this information problem in ways that the federal government has not. And I think, you know, I've listened, I mean, I'm in Los Angeles, I listened to Gavin Newsom's press conferences, and, you know, he is, I think, responsibly alert to the problem of uncertainty. And I think that he's sharing information in a way that I think signals to people, to journalists, to others, you know, that we need to take precautions, even though we might not be certain about, you know, at the end of the day, what the science will tell us. But this is what it's suggesting to us right now. And I think that's appropriate. That encourages the media to act in as an kind of accountability mechanism, without the fear of, you know, disinforming. It kind of models how we should be talking about these issues. I think that's very positive. It's just not what we're hearing from, you know, from the White House.
Well, I would say from the president, because there's some people up at the podium who I think are doing a terrific job of trying to explain what's going on. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do. I mean, even, you know, the vice president has done a pretty good job at that. And when I think he or, you know, Dr. Birx or Dr. Fauci are up there, I think they're being, you know, responsible. And also, you know, conveying the uncertainty that I think people need to understand. That's all good. It's just that, and this could be, you know, a media responsibility also. The coverage is going to the president and his, you know, some of his, you know, more kind of insane statements rather than, you know, the clear guidance that you get from the professionals.
Right. So on the question of the uncertainty that the people need to understand, let's turn to the tech platforms.
Yeah.
You wrote a, because I don't think they have been as flexible in representing that uncertainty. Maybe that's not fair. I just think they've had something of a different approach than the government for obvious reasons. So you wrote a great book called Speech Police, and one of the central issues that you addressed was this problem of a handful of American tech firms, tech platforms, controlling what's in effect public speech in this country. And I would state the dilemma this way. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but I would state the dilemma as we have an obvious concern about government regulating speech. And we normally think of the private sector as not subject to the First Amendment and the like.
Yeah.
But we have, in effect, a bunch of firms, a handful of firms who are profit-making entities, who are basically controlling the speech platform, who have speech criteria, speech moderation criteria that are much narrower, I would say much narrower than what the First Amendment or human rights law would allow. You could correct me on any of this if I'm wrong. And so the question is that generally correct as the statement of the problem? And yeah, let's just start there.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, yes. I think that is a good statement of the problem. I mean, the problem that I started with when I was writing Speech Police was a kind of fundamental question about speech in the digital age, which is who should be deciding these issues. And I was, you know, in my UN role, I've heard from so many people, mostly around the world, but also, you know, in the US, in communities that are maybe a little bit further away from Menlo Park, so many people who are alienated from the platforms because they do have so much control over public debate. They have so much, maybe control isn't even the right word, but they have this massive influence, this massive impact on public debate. And, you know, so if you're a European and you're active in public life, you know, so much of what actually gets out to the public depends on, you know, getting your message out through these platforms that control, you know, different speech rules. And, you know, this isn't so much a problem for just, you know, posting events and those kinds of things, as much as it's become, I think, a concern for many people around the world that when it comes to issues like hate speech or disinformation or harassment, the platforms are very disconnected from kind of the cultural norms, the legal norms, you know, the political norms that exist in a particular country. And that just created a lot of alienation for people. And I don't think it's resolved because governments have done very little, you know, even in those places where, you know, like in Europe, where they've been talking about regulation for a long time, they've done very little to actually regulate. And so the platforms still have this massive power.
And in response to the pandemic, I would say that, well, before the pandemic, I would say for years, the tech lash had kind of put them in what I described in a piece I wrote as a defensive crouch. And it seems that the pandemic, they've just come out of that. They're openly working together. They're very aggressively attacking the problem. The problems raised by information during the pandemic, the various problems, they are openly coordinating. They're tightening up their standards, and they said they've raised or lowered the bar, depending on how you look at it, for various types of speech that they'll allow on the platforms. They're looking to governments for guidance about what's information and what's not information. And they've had lots of controversial takedowns, taking down things that they deem to be misinformation that might have been contra information that would be useful for the public to know. So how in general should we think about how Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and the like are doing in the last 6 weeks or so?
That's a really good overview. I mean, one of your students, Evelyn Dueck, has written really interesting kind of analysis of this. And I agree with her when she writes that the platforms have been aggressive in dealing with disinformation, or maybe we could just say information about the pandemic. And so they're taking pretty aggressive steps in order to deal with, you know, both on the side of taking down content that they determine is a kind of harm, like creating harm. They've always had this for many years. They've all had rules that allow them to take down content that might result in self-harm, for example. So some of them are defining issues around pandemic coronavirus information as a form of, you know, that kind of harm. And they're being very aggressive in taking it down. They're also, I think, shaping the information environment on their own platforms by, like, anybody who's gone on Facebook or YouTube recently will see that they have these kind of knowledge panels or these interstitials that direct you very quickly to legitimate, quote unquote, legitimate, but it's, you know, public health information about the pandemic. So they're trying to direct people to appropriate information. You know, in the context of a pandemic, that seems to me pretty responsible. I mean, responsible, not irresponsible, but responsible. I think they're doing the right thing generally, but it does raise questions, first off, about, like, if they're so aggressive here, you know, will they essentially, like you suggest, like, come out of this defensive crouch of before and take an aggressive approach to other kind of content that people have been complaining about for a long time, like, you know, hate speech, which is not a legally defined concept, but they've been dealing with it for many years. I mean, those kinds of issues are going to, you know, they're going to persist, and people will start asking those kinds of questions. The other thing I would just mention quickly is there have been some interesting developments that just reinforce how powerful the companies are. And one of the best ones, I thought, of the last couple of months was when, you know, Facebook started taking down events pages in which some of the anti-lockdown activists, if we can call them activists, were promoting basically rallies that were inconsistent with public health restrictions about gathering in public and not maintaining social distancing. And you know, the companies took, or at least Facebook, took down those announcements. And, you know, this was done even without a legal request or request from government itself. It was as if the company was stepping into the shoes of government. And I thought that was really interesting. Before we even get into whether that's right or wrong, it does show how powerful and how, you know, government-like they're behaving.
But on that issue, I couldn't figure out, the news report seemed to clash on this.
Yeah.
They seem to be drawing, even if they weren't being told by state officials what to do, they seem to be drawing on state officials' concerns about the impact of those rallies.
Yeah.
Which would normally be extremely troubling. I mean, you basically have the government implicitly determining through the platforms what forms of protest will be allowed, is one way of looking at it.
No, completely, completely. And that's the concern that I had when I heard about that. I mean, my first reaction was, well, my first personal reaction was, I mean, what are people doing going out and rallying in such close proximity without masks, you know? But like, putting that part aside, you know, my sort of, if I'm using the lens of who decides these kinds of questions, you know, my question is, you know, these individuals, they have a right to protest. They have a right to, you would think, I don't know if I'd call it a right, but everybody has the ability to post about, you know, gatherings, events, and so forth on Facebook. Isn't it up to government, you know, to break up those protests if they're inconsistent with public health rules, or to enforce social distancing? Isn't it government's responsibility to do that, not a private company's responsibility to decide, you know, what can be publicized or not? And particularly if it's happening in this extra legal way, with a kind of, you know, wink, wink, nod, nod, but maybe there's an underlying sort of pressure about it. That really is troubling, because if it's not just this kind of protest, what kind of protest could that kind of pressure be used against? And think about it globally too, because that kind of pressure takes place all the time for the companies in authoritarian environments.
Yeah, but what you've just described is kind of, I would think, is a core statement of the problem. Namely, I think you even described it this way, but again, correct me if I'm wrong. Namely, you have governments on the sly kind of outsourcing public responsibilities to these for-profit companies who are enforcing speech rules that the government might or might not be able to enforce, but would certainly, if there are genuine reasons to enforce anti-speech rules because that satisfy the relevant legal criteria, the government should be doing it, not the platforms kind of in this kind of in-between world. Yeah. Based on guidance or hints from or pressure from the government under the guise of their private content criteria.
I completely agree with that. And the reason, I mean, the underlying reason for me is, you know, the companies are not accountable. They don't have any liability under U.S. law, or under European law, and many places around the world also have similar rules to Section 230, you know, in the United States, or the e-commerce directive in Europe. So they don't have any liability. So they can't be held accountable, but government can. And the problem with government kind of putting this kind of pressure on the companies to take down content is I think it's a break in our accountability mechanisms, our democratic accountability mechanisms. And if government believes that the mere publication of these kinds of events is a threat to public health, they should use their tools to, you know, order Facebook to take that stuff down and then face the democratic consequences of that. But if you just sort of suggest it and Facebook behaves, then what do we as citizens do when we want to complain about that? We don't really have anywhere to go except to, you know, I don't know, write an op-ed.
So I agree with that, but I think that the accountability problem sweeps more broadly, and you may agree with this as well. You talked earlier about how I guess I generally agree with this, how companies are trying to be responsible in warning about really, to use the phrase, dangerous information.
Yeah.
I have little doubt that they're trying to do the right thing here, but it's very hard to know what the right thing is, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm.
There's stuff, you know, again, we talked about how unstable the information is, and they're basically taking sides on a lot of these debates, and they may be taking the right side. I don't think they're always taking the right side. They're taking sides in the debate about what information is worthy of being promulgated in this crisis. At a very time when the information is changing every day and is unstable, and where you might think, set aside the externalities for a second, you might think that this is exactly the context in which we need more adversarial information rather than less. So how are we supposed to think about that?
Yeah, that, I mean, so I think about it in a couple of different ways. One is, I think that the pandemic highlights just how slow and in a way irresponsible we've been as a matter of public policy in not creating structures for, you know, for the companies to take decisions that are really on the basis of public policy, rather than what it seems to be right now is they may be taking the lead from organizations like the CDC or the World Health Organization, but at the end of the day, you know, it's in their interest, it's certainly in their business interest to make sure that the platforms are not used for, you know, for the kind of disinformation that can result in harm to people. The problem with that, though, and I agree with you, I mean, it's very hard to do this in a context of information uncertainty, but the problem with that is that it could very well lead, and I imagine it is, but I haven't seen data on this, it could lead the platforms to taking down, you know, quite a bit of, you know, of legitimate information. I mean, I hesitate to use the word legitimate information. Maybe I should say information that can help people make decisions about, you know, what they should do personally in the context of the threat. So, I mean, and you can imagine, again, I don't know all the data about what the platforms are taking down, but you could imagine people having a debate on, you know, on any of the platforms about, you know, what they should be doing about going to work or going to a restaurant or whatever it might be. You know, at what point does the platform step in and say, you know, your opinion about going to a restaurant in this environment, or your advocacy for that, you know, is counter to CDC guidelines, and we're going to have to take that down. Like, I might be overstating what they would do in that situation, but, you know, the line between where they are now and where they could be getting to is really unclear to me. And the lack of transparency around these decisions, which is even worse today because, you know, because like everybody else, the platforms are in lockdown as well. You know, the people who are deciding these and who could be pushing for more transparency, that's not really happening to the extent that it should. So I have to admit, like, I'm not sure, I'm sure that I don't have the answers here, but I also am not quite sure what the platforms should be doing on either side of this question right now. But I do think we need to have transparency so that we can debate it in an open way.
Okay, I'm going to get to the transparency point in a second. I want to say in the platform's defense, and you know this, it's not takedown or nothing. There are various intermediate things like providing information about why the information you're seeing might not be right, go look here, or lowering the information in priority. And there are a whole bunch of steps. And I do think that they think that they're only taking out offline the clearest cases that may lead to harm or may constitute misinformation.
Yeah.
It seems to me there are easy cases like, you know, speech advocating people to drink bleach, liquid bleach, because it's going to cure coronavirus. But then there are lots of harder cases that I think have been subject to takedown or at least to some action about, you know, whether the lockdown is unnecessary. Those two doctors in California were, I think, taken off YouTube, but not taken off of Facebook. There's the stuff about the anti-quarantine protests, which wasn't obviously the right thing to do, it seems to me. And in a way, dealing with this issue in a quarantine is kind of easier than in a non-quarantine because there are some really clear cases. So anyway, those are just reflections. But when you talk about accountability, so this is the point at which I run out of answers. It's easy to understand the problem. You're worried about the government regulating this speech. You're worried about the private sector regulating this speech. You, in some senses, if the regulation of the speech would be legitimate, as you say, you would want the government to do it because the government is accountable and the firms are profit-making entities that aren't really accountable in a democratic way. So, and they have profit motives and customer motives, and they're under pressure from governments. None of these are necessarily the right kind of pressures and incentives for getting the speech calculus right. All of that I can understand. I don't understand what, I mean, I know what the proposals are, but I don't understand what accountability, more accountability should look like. And I'm skeptical. You emphasize in your book and in your report that transparency is an important ideal here. I'm skeptical. I mean, it might be that if we actually knew the actual details of what they were really doing, about what the algorithms were doing and what kind of decisions human beings were making and what criteria they were using and how many decisions they were making a minute, it could be that it would be much, much worse. I mean, so it's not obvious. Now, maybe you think transparency will lead to some sort of reform. But in general, the question is, how should we think about accountability for the platforms in this context?
Yeah. I mean, I do. So my take on transparency is that for far too long, we have we just, you know, the rules have been, you know, expanding, thickening in all sorts of interesting ways. You know, whether you think it's a good or a bad thing for them to have more speech rules is, you know, part of that question. But they've generally been responsive to public demand for rules. But what we haven't seen much of, with some exceptions, we haven't seen much transparency about how they make those decisions, about what those decisions actually look like. And I guess it's true. I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to be in the position of just saying, well, transparency is the answer for accountability. I mean, I do think it's to a certain extent instrumental to getting to a place where smart regulation can take place. Because I do think that, you know, right now, you know, much as we're, you know, we're talking about decision making during a pandemic in a time of information uncertainty, I think that's how much of the sort of the regulatory discussion around the platforms has kind of taken place in an environment where people, you know, particularly policymakers, don't have a clear sense as to the nature of the problems that the platforms are trying to address. And it's been made worse because the platforms, like their incentive structure, isn't necessarily to share all the information about those decisions. So I'd like to see more transparency, but not, you know, not only because transparency allows individuals, users, others to decide whether they want to even participate on these platforms or not, but I think it would provide, you know, kind of, you know, a better basis for smart regulation on these issues. I'm not sure if I'm really getting to the question that you're asking.
Let me put it to you this way: that's a procedural fix.
Yeah,
and it's a procedural mechanism designed to lead to more accountability that might lead to criticism of the firms, maybe regulation of the firms. It might allow better regulation, but let me just say that. So I mean I agree with you. Maybe I'm just maybe not. It could be that we would be appalled and there's nothing we could do about it. I don't know, but I just think some of these problems deny procedural fixes. I think the problem of misinformation, especially in the context of speech at the scale and that happens, and the automaticity that happens on these platforms with the ability to weaponize speech in so many ways. I just think it's very hard to come up with criteria, and you know, they can do slices of it, like, you know, keeping certain identities that are deemed to be risky identities off their networks. But there's misinformation, and then there's misinformation about misinformation, and then there's the difficulty of distinguishing between misinformation and mere propaganda and mere tendential political speech. Yep. And once you start thinking about it, and once you think about the scale that's happening on these networks, it seems to me either that it's an impossible problem to solve, or that the only way to solve it is going to be This is a prediction, not an endorsement. I need to draw that distinction these days. But the only way to solve the problem as a prediction is going to be for a crackdown on speech, and including a lot of what we think of as valuable speech. So that's a serious problem that transparency is not going to help us fix. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I basically agree with that. And maybe it's useful to draw some distinctions between the different kinds of speech that we're talking about. I mean, if we're talking about harassment, or we're talking about fraud, the sort of the promotion of unproven, perhaps even dangerous remedies to coronavirus. I mean, those kinds of things, I think, fall into a relatively easy category. When you start to move along the spectrum of kinds of speech, you get to hate speech and then to disinformation that are extremely elusive when it comes to defining them. And so I really am concerned when I think this is in part, a reason why the platforms and others have been resistant to have clear rules around disinformation is because it is so difficult to define in a way that deals with the actual problems versus the kinds of, the kinds of robust, even offensive debate that we sometimes just have to, accept in rigorous democracies. And I think they're in a hard place. And I also, like, my view of disinformation comes from not only the way the platforms see that information, but also because so many of the public laws, so many governments have been taking steps against the dissemination of false information or fake news or disinformation that, ultimately, harm political speech. And so I'm really concerned if the platforms have, pretty clear rules around disinformation, the governments will use those rules in order to limit political speech. That's the direction that would head. And so, so I think, first, I think the way that the platforms have been focusing on, like Facebook just released, I think yesterday, its report on, coordinated inauthentic behavior and foreign inauthentic behavior, like those kinds of attacks, which are about, they're almost like how you deal with things like spam. They're kind of technical at some level, rather than looking at, is this information disinformation or not? Like, those are approaches that the companies can take. And if you go down the path of kind of viewpoint discrimination or deciding this is disinformation and this is not, I think that's going to be really, really problematic. And the final thing I would say just on this point is, I mean, I share the view that this is a really hard problem to resolve. And I think, much as people are now talking about, we may be living in an age of pandemic for the foreseeable future where we just have to learn to live with it, I think we're probably going to have to learn to live with disinformation and figure out the tools of kind of resilient democracies and resilient public institutions to deal with it, rather than just saying, okay, this information is kosher and this is not.
Well, I'm sorry to be a pessimist, but the very problem is that disinformation, as we saw in 2016 and we've seen increasingly, it really flourishes most in a democracy with freedom of speech and freedom of the press. It's at its most potent in that context. And yeah. I think it's easier said than done, and that you probably agree, to say we have to make our democracy more resilient to deal with this problem, since this problem is kind of making it harder for our democracy to flourish, if you see what I mean.
No, I completely see that. But I guess, and maybe this is where we both share a kind of pessimism about solving it, because I think the steps that we would say are necessary to deal with the disinformation problem are also the same steps that are most anathema to democratic debate. And that clash is really serious to me. And I don't know the way to solve that, which is why I do think that, the approaches to coordinated inauthentic behavior are good ones. I think that that's that's the bare minimum that the companies can be doing. But I also don't know what more they can do around specific content that would be, you know, that would be tolerable in a democracy. I mean, I think you're right that disinformation flourishes in a democracy, but I don't think anybody, well, I don't think we're in a position, I certainly wouldn't support, you know, junking the fundamental rules of the of democracy in order to deal with it.
Be clear, I don't want to junk the rules of democracy.
No, I know. You've been misunderstood enough recently.
Let me ask you, let's zone out. That's a great discussion of these current problems. Let's widen the lens with two final questions. Yeah. One, you've been special rapporteur for freedom of expression for 6 years.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure that during that period, Freedom House's annual Freedom on the Net reports, I don't know how rigorous these reports are, but every in terms of their factors are qualitative mostly and some quantitative. But basically every year, going back to 2010, I believe, but certainly since 2014, they've stated that there's been a decline in freedom on the network measured by various criteria. And I'm just wondering, at the 40,000 foot level, do you think that's based on your work and what you've seen? You haven't only focused on digital speech, obviously, but you have focused on that.
Yeah.
Do you think that's an accurate assessment? What's your 40,000 foot view of where we've been in the last six years during your time?
Yeah, it's not causation, right? I just happen to be experiencing this at the same time.
I'm not saying
I'm joking.
Keep on the network, David.
I think that much of what Freedom House has reported, I've also seen. I don't want to say that. So I think digital rights generally have been like under increasing pressure. And it's, you know, it's in all sorts of ways. There's been, we haven't talked about surveillance, although that's going to be a big part of the pandemic response. But, you know, we've seen an increase in the use of digital tools for targeted surveillance purposes. There have been some very high profile cases about the surveillance of journalists, of political opposition figures, of activists around the world. You know, we've seen an increase, like on the legislative side, of governments using, they'll often call them, you know, cybersecurity laws. Sometimes they'll be very specific, you know, fake news laws that are mainly aimed at restricting expression on online platforms. So, I mean, I share the view of Freedom House that over the last several years, we've seen just trends that are moving in the wrong direction. You know, whether they're worse than kind of the pre-digital age, you know, I don't want to go that far because, you know, government restrictions on expression have been with us, you know, for forever. So it just may be that what we're seeing is the space that was, you know, originally understood or celebrated as, you know, independent of government restriction. You know, people have over the last 10 years come to their senses about that and seen that, you know, as much as, you know, digital space offers like amazing new tools for access to information, it's also given government a lot of tools to crack down on speech. And I think we've just seen those coming to the fore a lot in the last several years.
Okay, so last question. I just want to give you an open-ended question to reflect on your time as special rapporteur since you're wrapping it up. I mean, give us high points or low points or lessons learned or views about the future. I mean, what is your, how do you see those 6 years?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, you know, it was for me just as a, you know, in a personal capacity and professionally, it's been a gift. You know, maybe you don't have this problem, but you know, when you're an academic and you want to have a conference and you got to bang down people's doors to write or to come or something, yeah. Like I haven't had that problem for 6 years. So I'm going to, I assume, like return to that.
I don't think you're going to have that problem anymore.
Very soon. Well, so, you know, of the highs, you know, I think that for me, so, you know, I think a kind of common discussion, certainly in the United States, it's like a persistent discussion around the value of human rights, of the mechanisms of human rights law. And I think one of the things that I discovered that I didn't understand as much before was for people around the world, how important the vocabulary and the mechanisms of human rights law are. You know, many places around the world, you know, even those that we would put into, you know, an authoritarian category, they have active civil society. And that civil society very often, when they're making advocacy for, you know, basic fundamental rights, freedom of expression, democratic rights, and so forth, they're using the language of human rights law. And I think that I've just come to see, and this is true in authoritarian countries, but it's also true in places like Europe, which have, you know, robust democracies. Maybe they don't handle freedom of expression in exactly the same way that we do under the First Amendment, but they are still, you know, freedom of expression friendly. I think that we in the US have kind of, you know, we've missed out in participating in the discussion around human rights norms and how they can be implemented around the world, in part because, you know, we have our own vocabulary of rights. And I guess one of my takeaways from the last 6 years is a kind of hope that on the one hand, Americans can learn the vocabulary of human rights in a different way and can kind of advocate for a certain kind of robust perspective around freedom of expression and other human rights. But also that I hope that the mechanisms for human rights, things like the Human Rights Council, Human Rights Committee of the ICCPR, other mechanisms out there, they're not perfect, but they can be improved and people rely on them quite a bit around the world. And I guess, you know, my hope is that the US can be more a part of helping rebuild that structure to the extent it needs rebuilding, you know, to improve them, because I think people rely on them quite a bit. I guess that's kind of a big takeaway for me at the, you know, if we're talking the 40,000, I don't know when I'll be next at 40,000 feet, but if any of us will, but that's sort of my thought from that high altitude.
That's great. And in closing, I just want to congratulate you on your very consequential term as special rapporteur. I think I've read all of your reports and I haven't always agreed with every word, but I certainly learned from everyone and you've just done a terrific job and congratulations.
Jack, thanks so much. I really appreciate that.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Goat Rodeo for all their audio engineering work and to Jen Patiahal for editing the podcast. Your music, as always, is performed by Sophia Yan. Please rate and review the Lawfare Podcast and share us widely. And while you're at it, check out thelawfarestore.com. You're probably spending much more time inside, so get some Lawfare socks to work from home in style. As always, thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.